You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
And I thought, motherfucker, are you out of your mind? Have you ever been in public? Like, have you not seen the lunatics that walk the earth?
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter. And I'm a writer. Bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Kara Blue Adams, who is the author of the debut story collection You Never Get It Back, named a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice and winner of the John Simmons Short Fiction Award, judged by Brandon Taylor, who calls it a modern classic. Over 20 of Kara's stories appear in magazines such as Granta, The Kenyon Review, and Electric Literature. She has been awarded the Kenyon Review Short Fiction Prize, the Missouri Review Peden Prize, the Meringoff Prize in Fiction, and a Pushcart Prize Special Mention, along with a Center for Fiction Emerging Writer Fellowship and support from the Breadloaf Writers Conference, the Suwannee Writers Conference, and the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts. She is an associate professor of creative writing at Seton Hall University and lives in Brooklyn. Welcome, Kara.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Thank you for coming on. We were just talking about how much we love your book and how much everyone loves your book. You were so kind to send us a PDF of it, but I wanted to read it off of my phone. And so I was calling around to all the bookstores in Chicago, including Barnes and Noble and the Amazon bookstore, don't tell anyone. And none of them had it in stock. And even Roscoe Books, who I love, said, we can, you know, it's on back order till February. And I said, that's okay. And they said, good luck getting a copy. And they were right, because it was impossible. And so I had to fire up my old ass Nook that I haven't used in years. Thank God it still works. And I bought it on Barnes and Noble, and I read it so fast. I loved it so much. It is just, I mean, it makes sense that no one can get a copy anywhere, because it's a modern classic. I absolutely loved it. And I want to hear you read to us now.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that kind introduction. Okay, well, I thought I would read just a very brief little bit from a short story called Never Gotten, Never Had. And I'll say You Never Get It Back is a linked short story collection. The stories basically all follow one young woman whose name is Kate Bishop through her 20s and early 30s. And this story begins the second section of the book. And in the first story in which we meet Kate, we also meet her college roommate, Esme. Kate comes from a kind of working class bohemian family. Esme comes from a more privileged background. And in the story I'm about to read, Never Got, Never Had, Kate and Esme have reunited after college. Never gotten, never had. Esme is coming, and it can only be a mistake. She has left her graduate program, dissertation begun and abandoned, and now she is drifting around the country while her fiancé completes an assignment in Rome. She met him at Stanford. The two things she tells me about him on the phone when she announces the news of their engagement and her plan to visit me are that he's taller than her, even if she's wearing heels, which is not a hard thing to be, and suggests he is in fact short, and that he wants to go to business school, preferably to Wharton, after he finishes his PhD in computer science, which he is on track to do next year. They'll see at that point what their options are, she says. And I'm tempted to say, but don't. So the first person plural begins this early, huh? Her voice is triumphant, excited. And when I ask about her decision to give up on getting a doctorate herself, she says airily, oh, there are no jobs. But wouldn't you like the satisfaction of knowing you did it? Did something stupid? No. If you love it, it isn't stupid. I don't. You did. It's all archives and libraries. I wanted to read and travel, and I can do that without getting a useless degree. If I have to write one more grant application, I'll throw myself off a bridge, I swear to God. Not that you shouldn't finish yours. Science is different. It's practical. How long is she thinking of staying, I ask. What I don't say is that this is not a great time. Javier has moved in because he asked to, 8 months into dating, and I stalled, and when he finally said it was obvious I wasn't into it, meaning moving in, but maybe also our whole relationship. I felt panicked and bad and said, yes, of course I wanted to live together. I was just nervous about my landlord's reaction. And now here we are, two people sharing an apartment too small for the both of us, or rather too small for him and me and my doubts. Not long, she says, maybe 2 weeks. 2 weeks, I say, in what I hope is a neutral tone. We can go hiking, she says. And I can see this whole thing is doomed. I'll stop there.
Kara, before we get into the particulars of these stories, because I know Lindsay has a ton of questions, as do I, I was really curious to know about how this book came to publication. I know that it won the Iowa Short Fiction Award, and I was curious if that was something that happened early on in a submission process for you, if you had gone through rounds of submissions and then decided to send to a contest, or I just wanted to hear a little bit about how this book came to exist.
Yeah, definitely. And that's always a question I'm interested in myself. And, you know, I hope that the answer might kind of help other writers and maybe especially story writers who are facing that question of how to bring out a story collection. So I worked on the book for a long time. Really, for many years, I was just writing stories. I wasn't thinking about putting a book together yet. I was just trying to learn how to write a story. And then after writing and publishing a lot of stories, I decided to put together a collection. And initially, it wasn't linked by character. And I showed a draft to a couple of friends who were writers. And two friends said, yeah, you know, the themes and the voice hold the stories together. You know, I would maybe just add a few stories and call it done. And two other readers said, you know, it might be interesting if because the stories are so different in form, they're very different in terms of where they're set. But some of the characters are kind of similar. It would be interesting to think about linking it by character. And so at that point I decided, yeah, that makes sense to me. I want a strong central through line to hold the stories together to hopefully make the book bigger than the sum of its parts for readers. And I decided to link it by character. So I revised some old stories and then wrote some new stories about the character who was emerging. And then I decided to show it to agents. And I signed with my amazing agent, Claudia Ballard, who I love very much.
Love her. Hi, Claudia.
She's the best. I really love the writer she represented. And I spoke with her at a conference and just really loved her and her energy. And so when she said she wanted to work together, I was just thrilled. You know, she had some suggestions as well. And I wrote a couple of new stories using her sort of questions and ideas as guidance. And yeah, then we went out with it to a number of presses. And, you know, I was expecting it would take a long time, but it all happened really quickly. And, you know, some people wanted to offer, but marketing teams weren't sure what to do with the book exactly because mm-hmm. it's not a traditional collection, mm-hmm. but it's also not a novel exactly, mm-hmm. which I had thought would make it easier for people. Thinking about books like Olive Kittredge or
Girls. Yes, we talk about that.
Comes up on the show.
Yes, I mean
Olive Kittredge is like the go-to. Oh, it's all of Gittredge.
Yeah. And, you know, so like a goon squad, you know, like it's, we exist. I'm saying we.
Yes.
You know, it's one of my favorite formats, and I know so many people love it as well. And it's interesting because those are called novels and stories, but you did not call this a novel and stories. And I don't know if that's like a marketing choice that was made or whatever, but it is called a collection of stories, right?
Yeah, I think Claudia sort of told editors, you can read it however you'd like. And some people said it felt like a collection, and a few people said I read it as a novel. So it's funny how that decision gets made. Yeah.
It is. It's so funny. It's like when you're going to grad school and you have to say, I only write fiction. I never try to write poetry or nonfiction.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I really feel for editors and for publishing houses because, you know, it's just so hard, I think, to know what's going to find an audience and how that's going to happen. And so, you know, at the end of the submission process, there were two editors we wanted to go back to with a revision of the collection, you know, potentially to make it a little bit more, I don't know, a little bit less novelistic perhaps. Yeah. They weren't really sure. We weren't really sure, but they were interested enough that, you know, we kind of thought, well, I've written so many stories. This book could look a lot of different ways. You know, we'll try some different combination out. And then Claudia went out on leave because she was having her second child, and then the pandemic happened.
Oh my gosh.
We sort of had to leave our tiny studio apartment in Brooklyn abruptly because we couldn't both teach from it at the same time. And I was going up for tenure. And I sort of thought, well, you know, I'm just going to send to just a couple of contests. Mm. And I loved Brandon's taste so much and really respect his fiction. And I just, when I saw he was judging the Iowa contest, I just thought it would mean so much to me if my work spoke to him. And so I sent it to just a couple of contests thinking, you know, it takes years often to win one of these if you are lucky enough to win. And then I got the news.
Oh my gosh.
And so then I had to, you know, call Claudia and say, hi, I didn't mention this, but I just, you know, sent this out to these contests. And it turns out that I won this contest. And she was thrilled. You know, she said she thought it was a great way for the book to come out. And we decided to move forward.
That's really cool that she was so down with it.
Yeah. Something that I really love and respect about her is that I think she thinks like holistically about her writers and, you know, sees them as people she's going to work with for their whole careers.
Yeah.
So a different agent, you know, I had a list of some more commercial houses that friends work with and, you know, suggested their editors might want to see the book. And so I'd asked her, should we try this? You know, and she sort of said, you know, I just don't think that's the right place for this book. I want to make sure it finds the audience it deserves. And I want you to be, you know, received in the way that makes sense for you as a writer. So I just, yeah, she's amazing.
How did you come to start the collection with I Met Lost the Other Day? Because it's a very interesting bookend. It starts with this almost like fable, mm-hmm. meeting this character Lost. And then the book ends with Kate about to become a mother. I just wanted to know like how you structured it, how you came to make these decisions, and how you gave yourself the permission to include a story from Kate's mother's perspective.
Yeah. So in an earlier version of the story, there were a couple of other fabulous stories. That's a mode I enjoy and write in sometimes.
Yeah.
But I came to find that there was just too much variety in that initial version. And so I decided, well, I'll just mainly, you know, include realist stories. But I Met Lost the Other Day felt like, even though it's an unconventional place to begin the book, it felt to me like the right place.
Yeah.
The book is so much, I think, about loss and mm-hmm. what we lose, what it means to lose things, and then what new thing perhaps comes into our life as a result. because I think moving through life is just a constant process, right? As time passes, inevitably we lose things. Mm-hmm. But then I think the time that you spend with the things that you've lost gives that loss a kind of shape, a kind of ghostly presence in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And also loss is just the necessary condition for changing and growing and moving forward. And so the book, you know, is very much about what Kate loses and what new meanings she makes in her life. And so, you know, my hope was that readers would be able to come with me, you know, in that leap from that fabulous story that's kind of thematically related, but not literally related to the story of Kate Bishop's life into her life.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you know, the story in which we meet her, which is the title story of the collection, You Never Get It Back. It's set around, you know, New Year's in 1999, New Year's Eve, 1999. And that to me, and she's on her way to a party. And that just felt like such an auspicious opening.
Oh my gosh, I remember exactly where I was. So I was like, okay, I'm in. Okay. Like I was around that age. I'm in. Let's go.
I love it. Where were you that New Year's Eve?
I was in Central Florida, Orlando. I was in a new relationship and I didn't even get to count down. I was on the floor of his bathroom trying not to barf.
Oh.
So not great. And Kate also had a very not great New Year's. So...
Oh, that feels classic. I would like to read a short story based on that.
I'll work on it. It's like I had Doritos to eat and then just like 12 cranberry vodkas. And it was not my best decision. That story, in addition to, you know, I Met Lost the other day, sort of setting the tone, which I think also sort of tracks with Kate becoming a writer as the book moves. And the way that she would sort of think about things. That story starts out, to me, it was very Sue Miller-y, and I love Sue Miller. It's just like this confident sort of like wry look at the people around her and her situations. And, but then it ends very differently. It ends shockingly and like a quiet shock. And I wondered if you could talk about writing that story specifically and how, I don't want to spoil it for people, but yeah, what was that like for you?
Yeah. So writing You Never Get It Back. That was the rare story where I actually began basically with the ending in mind.
Wow. Mm.
Yeah, it doesn't usually work that way for me. But if there's one thing I've learned writing a bunch of stories, it's that, you know, things often work in different ways from story to story.
Yeah.
Actually, with two of the most recent stories that I wrote in the collection, I actually started with the title, which is super unusual.
Ooh.
That
has never happened to me. I have the worst time with titles. Which ones?
I usually struggle too. Well, Never Had, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, that title came to me and I didn't know how it was going to be a part of the story. And it was so fun to kind of wait for the title to announce itself within the story.
Yes.
It reminds me of a song title. Actually, many of these remind me of song titles, but that one in particular.
Oh, I love that.
Yes. Someone write a song called Never Got, Never Had.
So writing You Never Get It Back, the story, I was reading a lot of Donald Antrim at the time. I really loved.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah. You both are fans.
Mm, big time.
Yeah, he's such an interesting writer because he has these three, you know, experimental novels, which are funny and weird. And then a memoir in essays, which is, to me, very funny, but also very heartbreaking and very real. And then a collection of short stories, which are much more realist than his novels.
Mm.
So, you know, I feel like he might appeal to a range of readers.
Yeah,
people might respond to different things of his. But his short stories, I think, are just masterful. They technically just do really astounding things. And in one of them, there's a really great party scene. And so I was thinking it'd be fun to write a party scene. And the ending of the story came to me. And then the first line came, and then I just followed it from there. And it came really quickly. I wrote it in maybe 2 days. And then I spent a little time just moving some lines and some backstory around a little bit. That part took several years, actually.
Oh my gosh.
Very little changed. Wow. But I would make these small adjustments and then put it down and read it again a couple months later. But most of it came in that first kind of 2 day rush. Mm.
I love that approach of having a sense that, you know what, maybe writing a party scene would be fun or something that I haven't done before. And then just going and doing it. One of the most useful things I ever learned in grad school was when I was studying with Stuart Dybeck, his big piece of advice was, if you don't really know, you know, what to write about, or you're stuck, just think about the kind of story that you haven't read before in a very basic way, just like subject. You know, have you read a great gas station story? No. Okay. Write that. Have you read a great, you know, I don't know, wash a pen in, you know, in the washing machine story? No. Okay. Own that. And I kind of love the idea of just staking something out or being inspired by something you're reading and just kind of approaching it in a basic way and then adapting it for your own purposes, however, you know, whatever they may be. It's a really great starting place.
I love that idea of his, and I'm such a fan of his. I love his work so much.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he's just incredible. But yeah, I mean, that strikes me as like a way to help you defamiliarize or
absolutely.
Yeah, what your material might be.
Right. Yeah, it forces you, I think, to bring more of yourself to it than possibly you might have, or maybe be a little bit less self-conscious if you already know, okay, hey, I'm at a gas station here. Obviously I know the components. Everyone knows the components, which is kind of the great part of having a broad starting place like that. And then what you bring to it, hopefully you're a little bit less conscious of, and you're able to get some words down. I don't know. Yeah. It can be a really helpful starting place.
Yeah. Have you tried that, Alex? Have you ever?
Absolutely not. No. I don't take any advice. I'm too stubborn and thick-headed, but I'll definitely repeat it out loud.
I was not expecting you to say that.
No, I'm terrible and precious and terrible. Yeah, it totally tracks. I'm such a full-on idiot, but yeah.
But such a great writer too. I know I keep bringing this up. I want to talk about the story from the mother's perspective, which is at the wrong time to the wrong people. I really want to hear you talk about that. Because it's very short. It's the shortest story in the book, I believe. And it's the only time we really get anyone else's perspective, but Kate's. And it's the story of Kate and her sister are younger. They're like in elementary school, I think. And it's the story of them deciding that they have to put their family dog down. And there's this moment, and I'm sorry I'm spoiling this for everyone, but it won't be spoiled because you'll read the story and it'll be just as affecting. She decides, you know, she's sort of waffling as the vet is, you know, helping put the dog down and thinking that she should have given the dog, instead of the wool blanket that she has given the dog, she should have given the dog the down blanket she has on her bed. But she can't afford to buy herself a new down blanket, so she didn't. Well, then when the dog has died and is being put in the back of the vet's truck, she decides to go get the blanket. And she gives it. She says to the vet, "Do you mind?" The vet shakes his head. He stands back, lets her tuck the blanket around the dog. The dog's legs are splayed unnaturally as though he has slipped on a wet floor. His body is no longer his own. When she secures the blanket's edges around his hips, his hindquarters don't respond to her touch. "I have given everything at the wrong time to the wrong people," she thinks. Holy shit. I will never forget that. I will never forget that line and that moment and that story. And I mean, it's, I mean, we can talk about this being the Stuart Dybeck putting the dog down story, but I'm sure there's other putting the dog down stories out there. And it's already, you know, that's already going to be an emotional thing. The emotions are right there. Everyone knows what that's like. If you've ever had a pet, most of us have. So it's genius because we're immediately there. We're immediately emotional with her. And we have had this, you know, 2/3 of the book of Kate, and Kate talking about her childhood and her mother and the tension in her mother's face and, you know, wanting to see her mother happy. And there's a moment, I think, in the story right before that, where Kate says, I just want to know why she's so afraid all the time. And then we get this story. And I just, it's brilliant how it comes right after that. It's brilliant how emotional it is, how beautiful it is. But that line is for all time. Like, that line is, you never have to write anything ever again.
Thank God.
You're done. You have done it.
You done did it. Great work.
We actually joke that the dog that my partner and I have now,
Blaze.
Yeah. That he's like so excited that I've published the book because, you know, now I'm done.
yes. Now you can just be his mom.
Exactly. He really does not love writing or reading increasingly because it takes attention away from him.
That dog knows what's up.
He does. He'll come up to me when I'm reading and just gently put his paw on my hand and push my hand to close the book.
Listen, I believe dogs know things, okay? And we have to listen.
I'm so glad that you responded so strongly to that story. It's a story that means a lot to me too. I, you know, one of the few things I knew was where that story was going to go in the book. It felt like it went hand in hand with that other story, The Sea Latch, about Kate and her relationship with her mom, and the disconnection between them and also the similarities between them too, I think. It felt, it's interesting. I think one thing I was thinking about when I put the collection together, actually put together and taught a graduate class on the linked collection as I was thinking about how collections work, because my partner jokes that my motto is, why do it when you can overdo it? And it's true. I was like, well, I can't possibly put together this collection until I taught a graduate class on the topic, read 50 linked collections.
Oh my gosh. Well, then, yeah, you are the expert now.
But one collection that I, you know, thought about a lot as I was working the book is This Is How You Lose Her by Juno Diaz.
Oh, yeah.
His book Drown as well, which meant a lot to me when it came out for a bunch of reasons. One being that he writes about, working class families and families that have experienced poverty, which wasn't something I'd encountered very much on the page. And just the immediacy and honesty of the voice in Drown and in This Is How You Lose Her really spoke to me. And in This Is How You Lose Her, you know, we have one sort of character throughout the book, Junior, and it's about his failures regarding women. And then there's one story in the middle of the collection that's from the point of view of a woman. Mm-hmm. And to me, it realigns the whole book. Or becomes sort of the center around which the other stories orbit in some way. And I love that idea that you can take one story and in this kind of kaleidoscopic way, refocus what all the other stories are doing through that story. And to me, moving into Kate's mother's perspective was an attempt to do something like that, to reorient the reader in a way that I hope is productive.
Yeah, because you could have easily, it could have been a memory that Kate had, you know, watching this happen, watching her mother's reaction, even watching her mother get the blanket. I mean, and she doesn't, she's not there in the story, and her sister are not there. But you gave it to her mother. And I just, I just think it's such a beautiful, profound choice that you made and paid off, you know, in spades.
Thank you. The first time I read that story out loud, actually, was in graduate school. And I'll never read it aloud again, probably, because one of my classmates just burst into tears.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Get up and leave the room.
Oh, God. It is so devastating and so the dog, but also her mother. And it's just everyone. I mean, please. Run, don't walk. I'm sure a lot of people listening have read it already because this book blew up, right? Oh.
I think I can't tell because it's been such a big presence in my life for so long, but it's been overwhelming that people have been reading it and responding to it.
It's vindication for story collections because we're told over and over again, and we're told over and over again specifically about novels and stories or linked stories that readers don't know what to do with that. You know, you talked a little bit about that in the submission process, and it's vindication because, like I said, I couldn't find a copy, and it was an editor's choice, the New York Times, you know, editor's choice, and you know, it's everywhere. How does that feel to have a book kind of take off like that?
Yeah, it feels amazing.
Yeah, good.
Feels really, really good. I think, you know, it was hard to let go of the book because it felt so private and so close to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've had so many friends publish books, and I know that it doesn't maybe, you know, solve things in your life in the way you can imagine when you're younger, for example. And so I just never spent much time sort of imagining how rewarding it could be to publish a book. I was just focused on the writing and yeah, to you know, be taken seriously by critics whose opinions I really value, to be read by people who've read the book so closely and carefully and thoughtfully. It's been really incredible.
Yeah. I think if Brandon Taylor says something about your book, you know, it's true.
Yeah. And you know how there are people who like just have really different taste than
yeah.
you? Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it would be great if, you know, someone with very different tastes, of course, liked my book, but to know that Brandon loves Mavis Gallant and Alice Munro and
yes.
You know, the same writers who are touchstone writers for me. and, you know, he has a background in science and Kate is a scientist, which is something I am not.
How so did you pull that off?
I felt so glad given, you know, the books that he loves, that he liked the book, and then just so relieved that he wasn't like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. Pass. I can't believe you said you don't have a science background. I assumed that you did because the details about Kate's work seem very specific and technical to me. So I was like, oh, Kara obviously studied this at some point. Wow.
No. And in fact, I read a very detailed book geared toward the general reader about the biology of sight. And then ended up using pretty much none of that.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Although it took me like 2 months to get through it. It was a really good book, but also a fairly challenging one. So what I ended up doing actually, you know, after reading that book and understanding, oh, you know, a lot of what I need to know, in fact, is not going to be contained in a book like this. I had lunch with a friend who's a writer, Keelan Hughes, really wonderful Irish writer. And her partner, Paul Berens, who's also a great writer. And I told them, you know, I'm sort of freaking out because I need to revise a few stories that are about, you know, someone with a background in optical physics. And I don't know how I'm going to learn what I need to know. And Paul just, you know, just sort of very calmly was like, oh, well, actually, I'm an optical physicist, or I used to be.
Oh, wow.
It was just like a dream. It was just like the solution to your problems just happens to be like sitting across the table from you. Like, when does that happen?
That just really confirms for me that we're living in a simulation and this book was going to be pulled from you whether you liked it or not. This book was alive, okay?
But he really sweetly, I sent him a list of questions and he very kindly like wrote back and answered all of my questions. And so that was in part how I was able to get some of what I got right.
Who else were you reading as you were writing and putting this together? You mentioned Juno Diaz. What other linked story collections did you admire, or even just like short story writers that you love?
Yeah. So many. So Jesus's Son by Dennis Johnson.
Yes. Oh my God.
Yeah. That book it's somehow never the same book twice.
Yeah.
Every time I reread it, there's something else that strikes me because the stories are so streamlined and compressed, but also so capacious. And
yeah. He's
so specific. The details are just amazing. The language is amazing. His work with images, and he's just incredible. And I started to think actually of the narrators being a little bit like if the main character in Jesus's Son, whose name is Buckhead, if he had lived in the Northeast and had a daughter who decided to lead a very different life.
Yes. Wow. Now I need to go back and read. Think of her as Fuckhead's daughter.
That's the subtitle of the book, by the way.
Yes, exactly.
Never get it back, Fuckhead's daughter.
Don't take that from me. That's going to be my linked collection.
You're right. I'm sorry.
And I'll dedicate it to Kara.
So, Dennis Johnson, Olive Kittredge. Really love that book.
Did you read the sequel?
I did, Olive Again.
Mm-hmm. Did you like it as much? I haven't read it.
I liked it a lot, but maybe not quite as much.
Okay.
Maybe because Olive Kittredge spans so much time and you get to know her husband and various community members. I love how capacious that book is.
Yes.
And Olive Again, I was thrilled to spend more time with her, and Stroud's an incredible story writer, but it feels not quite as capacious, I think.
Okay.
But still definitely worth reading. I read it, you know, in like 2 days and loved it. So I would definitely recommend it.
Okay. I will. I shall.
And then I also, in that class, I also teach Jhumpa Lahiri, Interpreter of Maladies.
Okay. I've never read that.
Oh, Lindsay, it's so good.
I know. I've heard that time and again. It's like the number of books that I should have read by now. It's really embarrassing.
No, it's fine.
There's no should, but it's just such a pleasure you have ahead of you. Like I'm
so that's true.
For you. that is a beautiful, beautiful book. She's a very elegant writer. Very sort of classic stories in a way.
Yeah.
And they're connected not by, you know, a single character, but by place. So India and then America and Indian Americans in and around Boston. So I love that book. That's another one I just return to time and time again. Laura Vandenberg as well, The Isle of Youth.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You mentioned something that you were sort of spending a lot of time like teaching yourself the story, like teaching yourself how to write a story. Mm-hmm. And something I really admire about her as well is like her openness about constantly learning and relearning these things that it's like, dude, you're Laura Vandenberg. What are you talking about? You know, but she is, she's just, you know, she's very open about like, okay, I've got to dive back in and teach myself how to do this again. And
I feel the same way. Yeah. She's always pushing herself. It's incredible. And now she's boxing.
I know. What the hell, man? Can't you just watch some TV like the rest of us?
She's incredible. Oh, and then Justin Torres as well. We the Animals.
I haven't read that.
Really? Yeah. It's really good. And if you love Jesus's Son, I feel like, We the Animals will be very up your alley. And that's a novel, but it's written in brief vignettes. And my understanding is it actually kind of began as a story collection and then grew into a novel over time.
I love that.
Yeah, it's like very compressed, very lyrical. He writes just like a beautiful sentence, a beautiful scene, and just carves away everything that's unnecessary. And it's about kids growing up in a working class family upstate. And it's both like heartrending and really funny too.
Love it. It's on the list.
And then there are like 30 others, but that's a good sampling. What are the other linked collections that you all love?
Hotel Never Sink.
Yeah, I was going to say, we had Adam O'Fallon Price on early in our pod, and he has a novel and stories called Hotel Never Sink, and it is incredible.
It's a killer. It's just awesome.
I can't wait to read it.
It's truly my favorite format. I don't get why there's such a drama about it, but I absolutely love these glimpses and then going out and coming back in at a different time. Mm-hmm. It feels more poignant in a way. I don't know. It feels more like meaningful to me. I don't know. I mean, I love novels. I read constantly, but maybe it's because I've got like a flash fiction background, but it just feels so, I don't know. It just ups the ante for me.
Yeah. I mean, writers like Stuart Dybeck and Dennis Johnson, you know, I think they show us like how much we don't need on the page.
Right.
Definitely.
And that's something I love about the linked collection form is you can just carve away what you don't need and just leave what's essential.
Yeah. It's so true. And I mean, a lot of times the connective tissue can even be an absence of connective tissue, and that's fine.
Ooh, Alex.
No, but you know what I'm saying? It's
Alex
true.
Alex Dybeck over here.
Get the fuck out of here.
No, that was serious. I'm being serious. That was beautiful.
No, let's never be serious. I wanted to ask, as you know, someone who's published in a ton of great places, obviously had a lot of experience submitting stories to journals and all types of journals, it looks like, you know, some amazingly, you know, prestigious and really well-known ones and some smaller ones as well. Did you ever hit a fatigue with that? Is it something that you still feel excited about, even though you've published a collection? Do you still feel like in it, or are you kind of, do you feel like, I don't know if I can just like keep sending stories out or having my agent send stories out? Is that something that you've tired of?
Well, I haven't done it since publishing the collection, but that's because I just published everything.
Take it all.
You know, when I first started sending stories out, the most helpful piece of advice for me was to, instead of, you know, aiming to get an acceptance, aim for 100 rejections, which, you know, for those of us who did well in school and like you work hard, you do your job and it works. It can be really tough, I think, to acclimate yourself to rejection and failure, which are such a big part of the writing and publishing process. So that was really helpful to say, my goal is just to get this in front of enough eyes that I can, you know, get, you know, find some good readers, and, you know, if they like it and accept it, great. And if not, I'll learn something through the rejections. And, you know, often if you aim for 100 rejections, if you're also showing your work to people who are good and honest readers, you know, you'll probably get an acceptance along the way.
Mm-hmm.
The
really bad readers are useful too, though. I think some of those really infuriating pointed rejections can just be such wonderful fuel for years that you're able to just quote yourself too. So,
Alex, give us an example.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I got one. I remember one time I had a character in a diner, and the note I got back was, no one could ask for that many coffee refills. And I thought, motherfucker, are you out of your mind? Have you ever been in public? Like, have you not seen the lunatics that walk the earth?
Like, just name a number. That's how many is possible. Like, you, like, give me a break. So I'll hold on that until my death. And I mean, I've published two books. He's published none. So whatever. Who's counting? Jesus.
Have you not seen The Lunatics Who Walk the Earth?
That is such a beautiful title.
That it's is so true, though.
Beautiful line. And it is also very Dennis Johnson-y.
It is. Yeah, I think one of the most helpful things for me as a story writer actually was for a number of years, I worked as an editor at the Southern Review. Mm. And just seeing, you know, thousands of stories every year and coming to understand how a story might be like kind of working, but not quite totally there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw patterns develop. That you can see in the aggregate, but it's hard to see if it's just you writing a story and not quite knowing what to do with it. So that really helped me start to approach my own stories with that perspective of having read like 3,000, most of which, you know, weren't quite getting there. And so I think once I had that experience under my belt, when I picked up a story of mine at the end of the day, you know, at like 6 o'clock or whatever, when I was finished with my work for the magazine, I mean, it was never done, but when I decided I was stopping, I would feel this sort of, I would feel like I was reading a story from the slush pile, reading my own work. And
wow. God.
I know. But it's like, it gives you the best eyes, you know?
Right.
Because if it was lifeless, I knew it wasn't just that I was too familiar with it because it was my story. I knew it really wasn't working.
Right.
And if it interested me and felt alive in some way, I knew it probably was really working in some way. And so then I stopped typically getting quite as many rejections because I think the stories were just more finished when I sent them out. And then also I had editors I had relationships with and I had some credentials. And I'm sure that was helpful too.
So you're saying don't spend 2 hours typing, get excited and immediately send it out.
That can work sometimes. That can work sometimes.
And then when it gets rejected 6 months later, give up.
That might not be the best approach. Unless your goal is to, you know, I don't know, your goal is to like make a lot of money, then maybe that's a great approach. You can become a lawyer and lead a different life.
There was something else, Carrie, you just said that I found so interesting because it reminded me of something J. Robert Lennon told us when he was on a while back. He had mentioned that he has found over the years with his students and maybe a little bit in himself early on that it's much harder for writers who were excellent students coming up in high school and college because of what you just said, not being used to the absolute glut of rejection and, you know, no's for consecutive years on work that has merit and how different that is for someone who's used to just getting it done, getting good grades, you know, getting through, pushing, you know, all-nighters, whatever it takes. And how that approach doesn't necessarily yield results early on in publishing and how difficult that can be for people who are wired in that kind of, you know, good grades, get everything done manner.
Yeah, that seems so true to me. It seems so true to me.
Definitely.
You really need, you know, you need to be comfortable taking risks,
mm-hmm.
to be comfortable with failure. You need to be comfortable, or maybe not comfortable, but you need to be able to do these things and do them again and again. Mm-hmm. And I think you know, you also need to learn, or I needed to learn to trust my own authority, you know, not to look to someone else for the right answer or for confirmation of something.
That's the hardest bit, isn't it?
Yes.
Because when you're told no, you know, even if it's a nice no,
mm-hmm.
you just think, well, there's something wrong with it, you know, instead of trusting in what was there.
Mm.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes I would send a story out to a couple of magazines and you know, one might be run by grad students who can be great readers and publish really interesting work, of course, you know, but sometimes it would get rejected there and then taken by like the Kenyon Review or something.
Right.
Like, you know, it's people come to the reading experience with different backgrounds and tastes, and one no doesn't necessarily mean the work doesn't have merit.
Definitely. And also the note, I mean, you know, there can be great edits offered up. You could even go as far as say correct edits or some kind of, you know, something that could elucidate a moment in the story, but it doesn't mean that you need to take it, and it doesn't mean that it's actually right. And I think what you were just describing about, you know, getting a sense of your own authority has a lot to do with obviously keeping out, you know, all the whack things you're going to hear about your own writing throughout your career. But also there's a lot of well-intentioned and intelligent things you're going to hear about your writing that don't mean anything. And if they're not coming from the same place as the best of the work, it doesn't have value. And until you really are comfortable with your decision-making in a repeated daily way, you're not going to have that.
Yeah, I think that's so right. And there are so many ways to tell any story. There's so many craft solutions to anything that you want to accomplish or address. And so I think it's really important both to learn to take, you know, feedback seriously, to see your work through another reader's eyes, but also to understand, you know, that you need to decide what you want the work to be, and that ultimately you need to make your own decisions about your goals and then how you're going to achieve them. What were your experiences like with workshops, with getting feedback on your writing? Did either of you struggle with that, with sorting that out?
I think a long time I was trying to write the way that I thought I was supposed to write. And anytime you do that, it doesn't work, right? Because it's not your voice. And so I was trying to write these very polished, like New Yorker style stories, and they were very like fine, you know? And until I just kind of like got really annoyed with myself and just said, you know, fuck it, I'm going to write the way I want to write. That was when things opened up for me. But even before, you know, even during that time, I was told that I wasn't good at plot. You know, I was told all kinds of crazy things. I think it's like Alex was saying, you have to like know what feels true, like really feels true. And know what is just like someone's preference, you know, because like Alex also said, there's a wide world of lunatics out there. they want to read all kinds of different things, you know? I think the best thing out of workshop for me was like learning how to read.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What about you, Alex?
I don't know. I definitely, you know, grad school workshop, that was helpful for me in that it was the first time I had really been around other writers. And, you know, I was barely a writer at that point. And it was like a lot of confidence and, you know, nothing on the page that was worth anything. And I think being told many times, you know, this is not it, just really helped me. I think people, you know, a lot of people are really down on, I think, the kind of more traditional workshop model and the way feedback is, you know, even was given as like recently as 10 years ago. People are, you know, there's obviously like a big sea change in how workshops are operating. But for me personally, it helped me just to have a competitive kind of probably too frank type of discussion, because it fueled me. I don't know. It made me work harder. And I definitely don't think that's the right environment for everybody to get the best out of their work. And I think, you know, hopefully you have a professor running the workshop who's able to kind of, you know,
address individual needs and kind of, because I think that's the way it should be. But for me personally, yeah, I didn't mind being told I was awful, so I could just like get fucking furious for a week and work hard. I don't know. That's a terrible answer, but it's the truth.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that became clear to me over time, I've been told, you know, you need to go into workshop with a receptive attitude and it's hard to hear feedback. And so I worked really hard on doing that, being a good student. I wrote that down. I was like, okay, I'm going to feel this receptive. I'll get an A+ in receptivity. But of course, you know, there's sort of two challenges there. One is people desire different things in their reading experience. So, you know, occasionally, right, one story appeals to a bunch of people. That certainly can happen. But if you ask a bunch of people what they might change about a given story, you'll get a number of different answers that could move the story in different directions because of readerly taste. And then the other struggle, I think, is that people have different ways of describing their reactions to their reading experience and what they might suggest changing. And, you know, especially in grad school or an undergraduate workshop, you're all still learning how to be good close readers and how to articulate your reading experience and how craft works, what techniques might be used in different ways. And so, you know, I went back, I remember just sometimes feeling paralyzed because I would get, you know, all sorts of different feedback that seemed to ask for different things and not really be sure what to do with the story after that. But I would save all of my workshop letters. And I remember going back to a set of letters, you know, a couple of years later. And at the time, it seemed to me like they were conflicting with each other, and they did in some ways. But a couple of years later, I could kind of see what was underneath what was being said a little bit more clearly. It was almost like often the subtext was where there was agreement. And I came to realize, oh, I forget what it was, but maybe there was like a lack of narrative momentum, or there was a lack of depth in terms of how the characters were characterized. You know, there's something that was clearly lacking in the story. And some people were saying, well, maybe the story should start 5 pages later instead of
such a classic suggestion.
Yeah.
The story starts here.
Right. Well, maybe. So I think just also learning sort of to read between the lines and to hear what was echoing through responses, even if they seemed on the surface to be in disagreement, that was something that it took me a long time to learn.
What are you working on now?
Characteristically, I am working on like several things at once.
Oh,
my partner is always like, you need to finish these books before you start. I drafted a book length lyric essay.
Whoa.
Excuse me.
There's nothing an agent wants to hear more.
No. If you loved me at my
short story collection to book length lyric essay, fucking get lined up.
But it was something I wanted to do just for myself. You know, we'll see if it ever actually becomes a published book, but I wanted to try writing something that was driven by process, which is not something I normally do. And so I was feeling a lot of anxiety about climate change and also the question of parenthood and whether that was something I wanted to pursue in my life. And so I decided to record the weather twice a week, every week for a year, and to just stand outside in the weather and just observe it closely as a way of kind of capturing the world as it is now. And to see where that led me in terms of my thinking about the world and my relationship to it, my relationship to solitude, my relationship to change, my relationship to memory, thinking, you know, well, that the weather's changing, the climate's changing. In 30 years, I want to have this document that I could give to someone who's younger, whether it's my child or not, and say, this is what the world was like in this moment. And so I have a draft of that, and I'm thinking about how to go about revising that right now. And then I'm two drafts into something that could be a novel. Ooh. I'll have to stop throwing most of it out if it's ever going to be a novel. God. But hopefully I'm not the only one who's had that experience.
You're the only one. It's weird. We're confused. We don't know what the hell you're talking about.
But... I always knew it. It's only me.
Yeah, it's only you.
I love that you're going to pass this beautiful document to whoever down the line, your child or someone else meaningful to you or your audience. And what I'm going to pass down the line is my Instagram.
Specifically my stories.
And I'm going to be like, see, this is what life was like. And you're going to be like, here's this beautiful, thoughtful document.
I sometimes think about those early conversations we had about like, oh, it'll be so interesting how the internet will change the novel, right? We'll have like,
Oh my God.
Remember that's so
embarrassing. Yes.
But then it feels like to me, sort of like, well, maybe Twitter actually is the novel that arose.
Oh,
I don't know. Maybe, you know, this document we're co-writing that captures so many interesting details and perspectives.
If that's the case, we need a lot of people to stop writing.
We need like...
I have a list ready.
Like a huge, yeah.
I have a huge goddamn list, and I am ready to publish it.
And on that note, Kara, I just want to thank you. Yes, you're not on Alex's list. I know that for sure.
No.
I'm pretty sure I could probably name half of it. I'm probably half on it.
Well, sometimes, yeah. That's okay. So am I. I'm on it.
I think we all need to be on that list for ourselves.
Yeah. Oh God.
Right. Healthy.
Yes.
Instead of tweeting, go outside and write down what you notice about the weather, everyone. Please stop tweeting.
I would miss you both on Twitter if you
Thank you, Kara. Thank you
so much. This was so fun.
Thank you.
Oh, did I do that?
What do you mean? Did you do that?
Of course. God.
It's so good. I love it.
It is not good.
No, it is good. I love it.
It's not good. What an idiot.
That was a fun one.
She's so great, and you never get it back. I will be thinking about for a long, long time. That part you that I read, love. Yes. That part that I read opened up something that I've been wanting to write about. I can't remember if I said this to you or if I said it to her, but I'm just repeating it.
Yeah, you said it on the pod, yeah.
Okay. So I'm excited to actually, like, it gave me access to something that I didn't have access to. So
that's awesome.
When that happens, I have a question for you. Why are we on Twitter? Like, why not? Why is I'm a Writer Butt on Twitter, but why are you on Twitter and why am I on Twitter?
Oh yeah. I have an answer. Well, two reasons. One, to laugh. Some of it is hilarious, and a lot of my friends are there making me laugh. And then also just, you know, to get mad every day. Because I need a lot of help to get mad every day.
Man, I feel like it's happening more and more often that I'm getting so annoyed and like mind boggled.
God.
At how like simple and petty and dumb people are. I don't know. And people angry and negative, and it's making me feel angry and negative. I feel like I feel like we're all on it too much.
I guess you're right. Objectively, you're right. But I don't care that much. It just makes me laugh. Like, you know, yesterday or the day before, like there were all these tweets that where people were like, I'm Gen X and I'm quitting Spotify and this is what I'm going to do. And it was like all these motherfuckers thinking they're changing the world because they're quitting Spotify. And it's just like, that made me laugh. And it was so stupid. They thought that they were making one bit of difference and they're not even a drop in the bucket. They're like, it's nothing. And to publicly declare that is just so clowny. And it made me so happy. But I'm meaner than you. So I don't know, like, whatever. I like all the people just making absolute asses of themselves every day.
Yeah. I feel like there's genuinely funny stuff happening on Twitter.
Yeah,
that I do enjoy. And like when big things happen in the world, you kind of want to go somewhere and like see what people are saying about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that like a lot of writers feel pressure to be on because you need to be seen and you need to have this like whatever. And I know I feel that pressure too. But like the times that I was off Twitter doesn't matter.
No, it definitely doesn't matter. But I mean, if I was going to give you like a more earnest answer, I would say that it does in some ways help you see how some of the writing and publishing world is put together.
Yeah, that's true.
And it does help you to kind of understand who knows who and who matters to who, where they work, where they, whatever. And even if you only understand a little bit of it, it actually can help instruct where you're going to submit stories, what kind of agents you're going to query, an understanding of what you even have, a better understanding of what is possible and what is not possible.
I feel like in order to do that, you have to put in all this time. And that's where I think it gets bad. You know, like, I think that's where it starts to just feel bad. And I think also like all too often, all of us forget that like Twitter's not real life.
It is not real life. It's definitely not real life.
Media follows Twitter. And so it's sort of confusing because it's like, what are you talking about? You know, like that doesn't.
Well, I mean, it's not real life and it is real life in a way because, I mean, just as an example, like let's say tomorrow the New Yorker takes a short story of yours. It would be a lot more fun for you on the day that it comes out online, you know, the night before the print comes out or whatever, to be able to send out that tweet and get a sense of some reaction live. Maybe some people, you know, get excited and it gets shared a bunch of times, or maybe you have some like great reaction from someone you haven't been in touch with, whatever. That experience, not that people wouldn't read the story if you didn't tweet out a link, or not that, you know, not that it would really impact the life of the story potentially, although it might. I think that some of the experience for that, like in that kind of purpose, and even on a way, 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 way smaller scale in New York or something, you know, whatever, just some little journal, there's so little recognition for so much of what writers do that when there's an intense focus on something like that, even if it's just in the Twitter world, it can be gratifying. And even if that's like embarrassing or silly or not real, it is real. And even if, so I don't know, I have mixed feelings about it, but I also just like, I don't know, I don't really think about it. There's so many things I do in my life that are terrible for me that I will just always continue to do and never change. And I don't care. I just don't care. I don't know. Like, I don't know. I can't get worked up about it, but I don't know.
I really appreciate that perspective. I truly do. Because I do. Yeah. I worry about it a lot. And maybe I should just be like, I don't care.
Well, you know, one thing about you in particular is like, you are able to just go on and off it easily, which I think is like, that's what's important. So if you don't want to be on it, you shouldn't be, you just don't be on it because you clearly can do it. You've done it for like year-long stretches, I feel like.
Oh yeah. I almost made it like 2 years.
Right. And I think the only reason you came back was because of this goddamn podcast. That's right. Like, yeah. So just
thanks
like,
a lot, everyone.
Yeah. Especially from you. But, yeah. So I don't know. I don't, I don't get that worked up about it, but
I appreciate that. It helps.
Yeah. What else you got?
Love that book. I started reading Liv Stratman's book, Cheat Day, which comes she's coming on next week.
Is it next week? Awesome. Yeah.
I think it's next week. Yeah. And I'm really enjoying that. And
cool.
It's this character who has started this like diet program, mm-hmm. but she's also like done that her whole life. So she's got like food issues and body issues. And
I'm excited to read this one. Yeah.
Like vibe with that because that's been my whole life. And,
yeah.
So it's like, it's funny, but it's also like pretty deep on that kind of stuff. So yeah, I'm excited to talk to her about that.
I'm really excited to read it. Definitely.
She's very funny on the socials herself.
She is hilarious. Yeah. On Instagram. I feel like she's on Instagram more than Twitter, but she's so funny on there.
Yeah. Other than that, I have a cold. It's not COVID. I took a test.
Thank God.
I took a few tests. What about you?
So tomorrow is my Friday. It's my split shift. And then I'm off Tuesday, Wednesday. I work Thursday, Friday. And then I'm off for 9 days.
Oh,
9 days.
That's amazing.
I know. I'm like so excited. And Britt is off too. So it's going to be unbelievable just to have, I mean, we're going to be working the whole time, just like unpack. We still have like our basement is finished, but it's just all boxes. So
yeah,
we just haven't had time with the girls. It's just like, you know, I mean, you know how it is. It's like,
of course,
if one of you is down there doing stuff, there's like a cap on how much you can get done. And then,
Yep.
So, and on that note, I just got a text that my younger daughter's up. So I'm going to go quickly.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop.
That's on my bucket list, as the kids say.